other times it's like, oh, nope, there's one area where I'm like a 9, but everything else is like a 2 and a 1 and a 7 and a 3, you know, it's all over the place. And so it's a really bumpy wheel. Again, not a value judgment, but an observation, because it's, well, what did you hope your wheel looked like? You know, is that, because usually what ends up happening is if somebody looks at it that way, they'll go, you know, my relationship wheel, if I'm honest with myself, I'll give myself a 3. I really wish it was a 7. Okay, great. What can we start doing to make it a 7? Well, you know, again, have a date night, you know, enforce some time together. Don't work quite so much, you know, be willing to give up some of the financial benefit for the relational benefit. Maybe your finance wheel was a 9, your relational was a 3, and it does mean you're going to have to bring your 9 down to an 8 so that you can get your relational up to a 7. But are you willing to give up that one area a little bit so that you can get big gains in another area? It's less about balance as much as it is about harmony. You know, you're trying to harmonize these things. And so it gets back to communication. It gets back to talking to each other. And what do you hope you're looking, you know, we're back to the same buckets, right? Yeah. What do you hope your life will look like? What are you trying to accomplish? That takes a certain amount of time. That takes a certain amount of commitment. That takes some discipline to sit down and do those things. And if you don't do them, then yeah, eventually you're going to drift apart and you're going to be that divorced couple and you're going to, you know, be visiting the kids on alternate Wednesdays or whatever, yeah. You know, that kind of life. Yeah. Is that what you'd rather have instead?
Yeah.
You know, or are you willing to give up a little bit in one area that, so that you can gain in these other areas? And usually when people look at it that way, they're like, well, duh, you know, of course I'm willing to give up a little in that area to get in this other thing. Again, the problem is we're so busy. We're all out living our life. We're all out trying to do the best that we can do with the information we have. I don't believe most people are, you know, you're not, most people don't set out to have a relationship that ends in a divorce. Yeah. You know, it's not like you woke up on Monday and went, you know, I kind of hope my relationship ends in a divorce. You know, I kind of hope we end up in court fighting about alimony. That's my future dream. You know, you don't set out to go there. You just drift there over time because you're not intentional and deliberate about not doing it. You know, there's a great YouTube video. You can look it up on Bob Newhart used to have this character that he played that was Bob Newhart, who was a psychologist. And he basically has a woman come to his office and she's dealing with some problems and some horrible dreams. He charges her $5 and then he basically yells, stop it, at her for like 5 minutes. You know, just stop it. You know, stop it. That's all he does. That's kind of the feeling you get sometimes when people are, you know, it's like, stop doing that. You know, what are you doing that's ruining your life? Well, stop that. You know, that hurts. Don't do it anymore.
Putting the hand over the fire.
And honestly, there's some truth to that. You know, there's a certain degree where it's like, identify the thing that's hurting and then stop doing it. You know?
So this is a key, I think, for most people when they're listening. I guess the advice is always like a suit. It can be a default suit, but it won't look as good as you tailor it is when it looks the best, right? You have to tailor the solution to the problem. So in your situation, I know you are basically your success story by all stretches of the imagination. You were able to come out of debt. You're continually being debt free. You're still, you know, pursuing different interests. Obviously you have some different hobbies as well. But before that, what was the breaking point before? How did you get into the situation you were in when it came to debt? Was it due to misspending? Was it to mismanagement? Or was it some investments that didn't pan out? What was your situation like?
So for us, it was the more normal American. You know, we made a certain amount. We spent more than we made. And we did that consistently over time. You know, it's pretty much that simple. We did see some things like we built a house, not as in we had a house built, but as in we swung hammers at nails and, you know, put boards together and built a house.
Wow.
And we would put, you know, materials on the credit card. Looking back on it, probably wasn't the best way to do it. But at the time, you know, it was like, okay, yeah, that's fine. And we did a lot of those things. We went out to eat. We went on trips. We did other things. You know, we bought cars that we really couldn't afford at the time that we bought them. We did all of those normal things and it added up over time, you know, to $77,856.41. Not that I know it to the penny, but I do.
Wow.
Right. Yeah. And that's when we looked up one day and we're like, we have more debt than we bring into our household in terms of income. You know, our debt number is bigger than our income number. And we want to start a family and we want to have children and we want to do. And at that point we had a young son and that was like, you know, this is scary. What, how are we going to provide for him? What is his life going to look like?
And if I can interrupt, like what age were you with your wife when you sat down and started looking at your finances seriously in this way?
So this was actually in 2006. So I was, late 30s, early 40s for each of us. Mm-hmm. You know, we were in that quote unquote late 30s, early 40s, mm-hmm. you know, early middle age, whatever name you want to give it, range. And it was really part of it. And I see this a lot where people have a family start, you know, they're suddenly a father or mother and it's like, now I have to be an adult. You know, yeah. It's like my life is changing because I've got this child coming into my life. Like I mentioned, I actually was suicidal because of the debt, because I believed, honestly, I wanted to be a good provider. And I honestly believed that if I could die and let the insurance money, it would pay off all of the debt and my wife would be better off. Mm. Now, you know, in retrospect, that was a not correct belief. And no, I didn't actually, you know, obviously I did not actually successfully commit suicide or do any of that, but I thought about it. You know, I had those thoughts and those dark thoughts and all of that kind of scared me and scared her. And I kind of opened up and admitted to her that this was going on. And at that point, we literally, almost like flipping a switch, said, we can't do this anymore. We've got to change what we're doing. And so we did do a lot of very deep soul searching about what are the core things that we say, this is it, this is what we're going to pay for. Everything else that we can get together, we're going to throw at debt and we want to get rid of it as quickly as we can. And we did. You know, I changed jobs during that time. We had, you know, our growing son during that time. We finished that house that we were working on during that time. And we paid off all of the debt in about 2 years, 11 months.
What was the hardest thing to
down the road? I was able to change jobs.
Mm-hmm. And not to interrupt too much, but what was the hardest part in restructuring the way you handled finances in home? What was the hardest, maybe frugal adjustments that you had to make? Because I know for some, like if it,
mm-hmm. so I'll give you two of them. I mean, the hardest behavior to give up was eating out. You know, eating out is a social activity. It's a convenience activity. It's a fun activity. You know, there's all of these different emotions tied to eating out. And we cut way back. Now, we still went out to eat, but we were very limited in when we went out to eat and whatnot, because we decided to give up a lot of that behavior and the emotional benefits of it for the financial impact. Because, by the way, the number one area that people usually are spending more than they want to spend is around food, and it's usually eating out. Mm-hmm. That I can tell you after looking at thousands of budgets, you know, most of the time it's like, okay, stop eating out so much and you'll have more money, you know, that when we're done. We're really not done, because how do you do that is the hard part. So that was the kind of mechanical piece. But the real hardest part was just changing our communication styles. You know, used to, I would stop at the movie store on the way home and I'd buy like three new DVDs. I didn't ask my wife. I didn't talk to her. Well, then she's like, well, he went and bought three movies that he wanted. You know, that was $100. So I'm going to go spend $100, yeah. You know.
You're giving each other a shovel. Yeah.
I don't blame her, you know, and yet now we're $200 in debt instead of, you know, even just half that problem. And because we weren't talking about it, we weren't on the same page. We didn't agree about what we were trying to do. So once we got that alignment, then the other stuff, the mechanical stuff, like stop buying DVDs, stop going out to eat so much, that was easier, you know, but so the communication piece was really the hardest part.
So when, obviously, you had somebody that was very supportive, but also, I mean, just like anyone else, no one's perfect. Was there any pushback once you started getting on this budget or this restructuring of how you spent money? Was there any, at like maybe first month was easy, just like a new diet or a new workout, this is going to work out, and then like a month later you're like, okay, we need to really stick to this budget. Was there any of that situation in your experience when you were doing it?
Yes, and it was me. I'm the spender. My wife's attitude was about time. She was much readier to go than I was. She found it easier to give things up than I did.
Wow, that's not a typical answer. That's interesting.
Yeah. So I'm a nerd spender. So I love money and finances and all of that, but I also like to spend money. And so I have to put in structure and discipline and these sorts of things, or else, I'll go drop $400 in a weekend. Doesn't bother me a bit. That's like, let's go. This is fun. So I really have to temper that, where she's much more naturally frugal. That's kind of her natural bend. At the same time, there were things that she's like, I really want to keep this in the budget. Whatever. I'm trying to think of an actual example.
Like new clothes or hair or nails or something like that, or house supplies.
She's not a hair or nails lady, but it was more of around the kiddo and around certain things that we needed to provide for our son. So like literally at one point she's like, we've got to increase the school supply money. And I'm like, how can we do that? We can't afford it. She's like, look, come to the store with me. So I literally went to the store with her and we shopped together, and I'm like, okay, you're right. We have to increase the school supply money. I get it now, because I literally just didn't know what the prices of items were, because I wasn't the one doing the shopping. And so there was more, there were tension around those sorts of things. For me, it was much more, I wanted to keep a certain number of trips in the thing, and I wanted to go on vacation for certain things. So again, we found a way to go, okay, we're not going to go on the week-long vacation. We're not going to go do anything super fancy, but here's a way we can go get away for a weekend and kind of do it on the cheap, So we still found ways to do the things that were important to us, but we did it in ways that didn't impact the bigger thing for the most part. But yeah, I'm the spender, not her. So I was definitely the bigger problem child when it came to all of that.
It's interesting because I think a lot of people would say the opposite, but it's interesting to see that. I think it's an interesting dynamic because it shows that the commitment obviously has to be on both sides, but a supportive spouse, regardless, is a person that, is able to highlight those issues and kind of help talk them through it instead of, reacting in a maybe unmannered way, But so
yeah, I'm not going to say we've never fought about money, because we certainly have, but
I think everybody has.
Pretty quickly, we found a way to get to a point where it's like, okay, let's not fight about this. Let's actually just kind of figure it out. Let's figure. So we started doing things like, sitting down and writing out, okay, what do you want to spend money on? How much would it cost? And doing a spending plan, AKA a budget, mm-hmm. And finding a way to make sure that both of us had things in the budget that were important to us, and both of us were giving up things that were important to us too. So it wasn't always one side or the other. If one spouse is always the one that sacrifices and the other one gets everything they want, that's really not a great relationship long term. Somebody's going to resent that eventually, and there's going to be a problem. And again, I've seen it on both sides. It can be the man, it can be the woman. There really isn't a gender to this, mm-hmm. as much as there is it's a lot more about history and attitude than it is about gender. I know there's stereotypical gender things about the man and the woman that. And there are some things that are patterns, but there's also a lot that's much more balanced and different than I think a lot of people believe.
Yeah. No, well, I think that's a very important call out, because it is true. In my relationship, I think with my wife, I think I tend to spend more than she does. Or at least she spends more, but I think I spend on the higher end things. Like she'll spend like $30 on food in like 3 days or something, right? Takeout. And I'll spend like $40 on a statue of a hard drive that I definitely don't need. I just want to have because it looks nice. But there's things like that, right? I think the type of spending, although I can sell that. Well, actually, that's part of what I was going to ask you next. So when you had a restructure, were there any things you had to sell or get rid of in order to kind of push to get to your goal faster, or did you kind of move around, like, not if you had any collectibles like golf clubs, cards, or whatever it might be, did you decide not to sell any of those things?
Yeah, we really didn't have a lot of stuff that we could sell. We were in that situation where, you know, we did sell some things. I mean, we had, you know, garage sales and would make $300-$400 here, $200 there, or something like that. Mm-hmm. But we did most of it by, you know, changing our behavior around spending and then, you know, finding ways to bring in extra income. So, you know, she got a job for a little while that wasn't, you know, wasn't her favorite job. She didn't want to do it forever, but she literally called the paychecks the getting out of debt paychecks, because we could live on what I made and do everything on what I made and pay some on debt, but all of her income went towards the debt. Literally every paycheck we would write a check, pay off, you know, write a check, pay off more, write a check, pay off more. So it was a combination of those sorts of things much more than it was selling. Now, again, I've had clients where it's like, you know, they've got motorcycles and toys and other things that they look at and they go, you know what? I don't want the toy as bad as I want to get out of debt, so I'm going to sell it. And that can be helpful. But again, it doesn't, if you're in the situation where you have that, can do it that way, great. And if you're not, you can still do it. It's just a matter of making those choices and figuring out a plan that works for you.
Yeah, there's I know that in some families that I've met, when they got into debt, as they needed extra cash here and there, what they would do is get rid of a kayak because they're not planning to go kayak for a while, especially with the situation they were in. They got rid of snow clothes and stuff like that. And then when, of course, the season came around, they would come out, and now they had to buy it at market rate, right? So now they would spend double to get the same thing they sold earlier. And I think that's something that people like forget, that their hobbies might change for now because of their debt reconstruction or whatever they're doing personally. But if you already have it and you own it, maybe if it's costing you a lot of money to store it, then I obviously get rid of it. It's not worth it. But if it's just taking up an extra, it's like a sore eye, or, you know, it's just an eyesore because it's there in the room, maybe just keep it there until you know for sure that you're not going to need it. Because I feel like that's something that people forget.
A lot of times that people do things, you know, short-term gain for long-term pain, right?
Yeah.
You make a decision in the moment, like, oh, it's scorched earth. You know, it's one of my problems. You'll hear a lot of the get out of debt gurus who are like, you know, scorched earth, do everything, you know, sell it. So make the child think that they're going to be sold next, you know, sell everything you own and, you know, move into a van by the river. That's how you can do it. And for some people, that's the right thing to do. But the truth is, it's also like crash. Sometimes it's like crash dieting. You know, people will go on a diet and they'll lose 50 pounds because they want to look good in the bikini or the bathing suit, or they, you know, they want to fit into the tux for the wedding or whatever it is. And then they gain it all right back.
Yeah.
Because they didn't really change their fundamental outlook and behavior. They just went on a crash diet. Yeah. So it can be that, you know, if you're in that mode of, you know, sell everything, blah, 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 that you just turn right around and go right back into debt. And I've seen it happen. I've seen people that have come to me and it's like, we've gotten out of debt 3 times before and it's never stuck. And now we want to work with you because we want to make this stick. Mm. You know, why? Because getting out of debt, remember, is a goal. It doesn't have a why.
It's like losing weight too, right? You have to do it and then make sure you don't let it come back on.
Right. It's the difference between losing weight and developing a healthy lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Developing a healthy lifestyle means you're going to keep the weight off. Yeah. You know, you're going to look good in the tux today, and you're going to be healthy for the next 10 years. And, you know, yeah, you may have a few extra inches or a few extra pounds, because most of us do, but you're still eating healthy and you're exercising and you're doing the things that you need to do to be healthy, to have a long-term healthy outlook. Same thing happens with our money. Are you going on a crash diet because your goal is to just, you know, oh, we got to pay off the credit card right now because it's got so much interest. And so we're going to sell the kayak. We're going to sell the Jeep. We're going to sell everything. And then in 6 months, you're like, yeah, but now we want the Jeep back. And you go back and buy the Jeep. And now, like you said, a lot of times now you buy it and actually make the situation worse instead of better, because
yeah.
you sold it cheap and bought it expensive, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, you're buying high, selling low. Yeah, exactly.
You sell when it's low and buy when it's high is the exact opposite of how to make money. And yet we do it because it's an emotional thing. That is, you know, that's the flip side, because I keep tying everything back to emotion. But recognize that's a double-sided coin, right? There's the good side of emotional decision-making, and then there's the bad side of emotional decision-making. Sometimes when we make decisions out of emotion, we make a rash, sudden, quick, do-it-now kind of decision and don't think about the long-term consequences. And then now we have to deal with them, whether that's diet, whether that's career. You know, think about it. You know people that have walked into the boss's office and said, take this job and shove it. You know, and quit.
And then that's true.
3 weeks later, they're like, "Oh my lord, what did I do?"
You got to pull a George Costanza.
At Wendy's or whatever.
Yeah, you pull a George Costanza, show up on Monday, like, "I'd never quit. What are you talking about?" Because it's just a rash decision. Exactly. You know, I like that you said that, because most people come to you probably looking for a financial diet when they really need a financial, like, life change, right? You don't need a diet. You need to change the way you look at things and you do things in the long run.
You need to change your lifestyle.
I love that you said that. Mm-hmm. I've never thought about it. I'm going to be using that going forward, but that is so true. The parables to those two, they're so likened to each other, right? Because it is true. You got into a not healthy way by, you know, compounding issues over the years. And it's going to take a little bit of time.
1,000 tiny decisions.
Exactly. That's so true.
1,000 tiny decisions. It's not usually, again, most people, I mean, yes, somebody can have a heart attack and that's a sudden medical event. But even there, a lot of times that heart attack was precluded by 1,000 decisions that came before it that created the situation that now you have a heart attack.
100%.
Yeah, the same thing happens with our financial life. Yeah.
So
the other part of it, go ahead.
No, please go ahead. The other part, yes.
The other part that I would call out, you know, is, again, you know, early on I said I work in time, talent, and treasures, but the truth is all I work in is talent, your mindset, their beliefs. This is what I mean by that, because whether it's your financial life, whether it's your health life, whether it's your productivity life, whether it's your career life, whether it's your relationship life, whether it's your spirituality life, all of these things really tie back to you. You know, no matter where you go, there you are. You show up, and your attitude in one area often spills over into others. Your discipline in one area often spills over into others. Your lack of discipline in one area often spills over into others. And so you see, you know, I have people that come to me, they're like, I want to, you know, get out of debt. I want to get my financial life in order. And we start working on getting their financial life in order and developing new habits and new mindsets around their money. And they're like, why am I losing weight? And it's not because they're starving themselves. It's literally just because now they're paying attention.
Yeah.
And as they're paying attention, they start paying attention in other areas of their life. And they're like, you know, I probably should put the, you know, I know the gallon thing of ice cream says that it's got 10 servings in it, but we all know that that's a single serving.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, maybe I should actually not buy that, right?
You know,
that
Ben and Jerry's tricks you. Yeah, so true. Yeah, because you're not going to sit in there and just take exactly 3 teaspoons.
The pint is a single serving. Come on.
Oh, I love that you're saying that. That's so true. Yeah, many people look at it. Everything in life is supposed to be in some sort of moderation, but when you're having fun, the excess is just what you're naturally going to lean on. That's just how it goes. That's so true. And
it's easy.
Yeah. In fact, you can use your money in a way that can benefit you in many other ways, right? Like, you can spend $1,000 on a flat screen TV and now you're to get the benefit out of it, you have to sit at home and watch something on it. Or you can spend $1,000 on two sets of mountain bikes and a year pass to, like, you know, a state park or something. But you choose what's going to benefit you. And I think as you start cutting down on excesses, you realize that, well, now I cut out my subscriptions. I don't have cable and I don't have subscriptions. What do? I'm going to go on a walk. And naturally, you start becoming healthier in many areas. You know, I'm gonna start reading a book. I'm going to go to the library. I'm going to do something that doesn't cost as much as I would normally do. And then all of a sudden, you start discovering new things. And I think that's such a wonderful way to look at things, because you're highlighting things. I really didn't think about that, but that in my personal life, that's what happened too. You know, even podcasting came about from cutting expenses in other areas. I'm like, you know what? I like listening to podcasts. I love Dan Carlin, like, hardcore history. And now I'm listening to podcasts. I'm walking, taking walks, which I never did before. Those are little things like that you're, what highlights? That's so cool. Did you find that happening to you too? Like, did you see that as a change?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I like you just said, I started listening to podcasts. Why? Because they're free. You know, I mean, that was the main reason why. And it was still educational because I was a voracious reader. I used to read 50, sometimes even 60 books a year.
Wow.
I still read a lot, but I also feed my mind, you know, through podcasts and other things now. So some of it is finding ways to still get what you want, but not necessarily spin. So you're not feeling deprived. You're still feeding, you know, that itch, but you're not doing it the same way. And again, you know, I got to the point now where if I want to buy a book, I can buy a book, you know, it's not a big deal. But yeah, there, for a while it was like, okay, I'm only going to check books out from the library and listen to podcasts and free stuff, you know,
yeah.
Because I was able to do it. I still could feed the itch, but I didn't spend the money. You know, a lot of times what we're looking for is the easy button. You know, we're looking for that Staples easy button. Yeah. You hit the red button. It's like, it's easy. You know, and it's not easy to get either way. You know, you usually don't cause the problem by one fell swoop. You do it by a thousand little decisions, and you usually don't get out of the problem by one fell swoop. You usually do it by a thousand little decisions because I love the people that are like, I'm $70,000 in debt. It's like, really? How long did it take you to get that, you know, far into debt? Oh, 3 years. But I want to get out by the next month. Like, probably not going to happen.
Not in a healthy way.
It took you 3 years to get here. It's probably going to take you a little while to get out, you know? And like you said, not in a healthy way.
Yeah, you're so going to find a casino or something to make that back.
That, yeah, and that's, you know, let's just say when you go to visit a casino, just remember that big, beautiful building was built with the money of people that were thinking they were going to gamble again.
That's so true. Yeah, they come in thinking they're going to be the exception to the rule. But okay.
You know,
yeah,
so
exactly.
More people lose than win. That's how the math works. Yeah. Otherwise, the casino would not stay open. So, you know, does that mean you can't gamble for fun? No, you can gamble for fun. And yes, maybe you win something big and all of that. But it mathematically,
it's
and
not a good solution for your problems.
It's not a solution to your problem.
It's going
to
create more, you know, for sure.
And the worst, in some ways, the worst thing that can happen is you can win.
Yeah, because then you get the itch, right? Then
you
get the itch
it.
Again. You want to go back in. I'm like, you know what? I was a hero once. Maybe I can do it again. I'm like, hey, you can't fit in that. Don't try to do it again because you never know what can happen. People end up losing their cards, their title right there. And then they come back home on an Uber. Things didn't go well.
Yep.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I've seen people end up in pretty bad situations. You know, where are most lottery tickets sold? In the lowest socioeconomic areas of the city.
Man, that's so true. Yes, that's so true. Yeah, and people, for some reason, even if they know that information, they still think they'll be an exception. A lot of people don't wake up to that.
You know, my joke is a lottery is a tax on people who are bad at math.
That's... Well, oh, man. That's so true. That's so true, you know? Oh my God. After all,
if you understand the odds, you're like, I'm not going to play. That's,
if the pot's $1 billion, you have to wonder why, how it got there, right? It didn't get there magically. Yeah. It kept accumulating over other people doing the same thing. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I also wanted to ask, so as you were mentioning, you changed habits. The audiobook is one thing. Podcasting is another thing that started, you know, I said audiobook. You said podcasting. But as those hobbies developed into maybe things you were passionate about and you wanted to now contribute to, what was, I guess, for you, what did you, some people believe that a hobby needs to make revenue back. Some people believe that a hobby should be something you do with your free time, your spare time, and that you enjoy doing, and that it shouldn't overshadow your personal life. Some people believe there's a balance. Well, what's your belief at looking at hobbies? Because I'm sure they changed as you made this plan to get out of debt. And then after you did that, you changed. I mean, your lifestyle was changing in the process. So right now it's a residual of those right decisions. How do you see hobbies?
I don't think there is one size fits all, one answer to it. You know, some people, for one thing, if you're going to monetize your hobby and that's going to make you hate it, then don't do it. You know, that's a mistake because now you hate something that you love just because you're earning money around it. But at the same time, oftentimes looking at your skills, looking at things that you're good at and you enjoy doing, they can be a source of income. So it's not a, you know, yes, do it, don't do it kind of thing. For me, you know, one of the reasons is like I have my own podcast. Why do I have a podcast? Because I don't like to write. And I was trying to get ideas out of my head and I don't like to write, and I like having conversations with people, and I've always been enjoyed speaking. So let me start a podcast because it aligns with what I like to do, but also gets the benefit and puts it out in the world and does all of those things and becomes a marketing arm and yada, yada, yada. So, you know, how can I align my passions and gifts with what the world needs? And I can put it out in a way that a lot of times becomes a good source. And, you know, hobbies could be a source of that. At the same time, like I said, if you've got a hobby that it's like, if I charge money for this, I'm going to hate it. Don't do that. You know, don't turn it into something you hate just to, for the source of money, because, you know, there's other ways to earn money. You can find a different way. You know, I'm a firm believer. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but I think it's Ikigai is how you pronounce it.
Oh, yeah,
it's a Japanese word, you know, a reason for being. And it's got kind of four circles that all overlap. And, you know, the first circle at the top is what we love. And the second circle on the right hand side is what the world needs. The bottom circle is what we can be paid for. And the left hand circle is what we are good at. So what we're good at and what we love, where that overlaps, that's a passion. That's something we're passionate about. Oftentimes hobbies fall into that category. And what we love overlaps with what the world needs. That's a mission. You know, that's something that we feel driven to do, is kind of a missional thing. And then what we're good at and what we can be paid for, where those overlap, we often would call that a career or a profession. And then where what the world needs and what we can be paid for overlaps, that's a vocation or a calling. The word vocation actually comes from vocal calling. Yeah. So what's interesting is if you put all four of those together, they, you know, in this concept, it says having all four of those into one means a reason for being. And you could find, it's possible to find that one core thing that touches all four of those circles. I would also say it's okay to make sure all four of those circles are touched, maybe by two things or three things. You know, in other words, you do need to make sure that you're touching all four of these circles. You're doing things that you love. You're doing things that you're good at. You're doing things you can be paid for. And you're doing things that are what the world needs. Usually, some of those will overlap with certain activities. So your career may be what you're good at, what you can be paid for, and something that you love. It may overlap those three. Well, then you got to find something else that feeds that what the world needs center of your mind. You know, that hole around what the world needs. Maybe that's a spiritual activity or a missional activity or something that you do in that form. So it's identifying where is my gaps and what am I doing to fill those gaps. Sometimes that's with one activity, sometimes it's with more than one. But making sure that you're able to feed all four of those in a way helps us feel like we have a reason for being. You know, this is what I'm put on the earth for. For me, that coaching kind of fits all four of those. I do it as a mission. I do it as a passion. I do it as a vocation. I do it as a profession. But I've seen people that, you know, they don't have that one single thing. They have two or three components that kind of fill all four of those.
I love that you're saying these things. You speak with knowledge and wisdom, I think, far beyond your years. And I think that comes from the fact that you have a habit of listening to different podcasts. You like to read. I think that feeds into how much you have as a person. But was that always the case? Did you grow up in a family of people that like to read, or is that something you developed on your own as you were growing up? Like, how was your upbringing to get to where you're at now? Like, who?
Yes. So I learned to read at a young age. I actually came home from kindergarten and I was angry and told my mother I was never going back to school. She said, why not? I said, they haven't taught me how to read yet. I'd been there one day. You know, now luckily my mother was a first grade teacher. So she's like, all right, I'll teach you how to read. And she started teaching me how to read. And basically by kindergarten, I'd read all the first grade readers. So when I got to first grade, I'm like, I've already read all these. And so I was reading the second grade readers. And by the time I was in like fifth grade, I'd read everything. So they would just send me to the library in the elementary school. And I actually got to be very good, close, personal friends with the librarian. She and I would sit down and order books together. You know, literally I got to order like, this is what I want to read. And she'd order it and I'd get it in the library and I'd get to read it. So, you know, I've always had that passion for reading. I've also always been that guy that likes to, likes to interact with other people to learn with them or from them or beside them. So I was the guy that everyone wanted, you know, tutoring help from and all of that. Not because I'm necessarily smart as much as I kind of liked sitting down with people and have figuring out, okay, how can you learn this? You know, how can you figure this out? What's good for you? So my mom's joke is, you know, Scott, you've been coaching since you were 8. You just now put a name on it. You know, you've been doing that, you know, since you were 8 years old. That's why I think for me, that comes back to, you know, I've discovered or rediscovered, you know, that kind of passionate profession that kind of feeds all of those circles that I was just talking about. But, and I think a lot of times it does come out of examining your childhood. Now, I'll be honest, part of the reason I developed as a reader is because I also had an alcoholic father at home who was emotionally abusive. And so I used reading as an escape because I could go to the room and read. So it came out of, you know, some negative life experiences, but I've also found a way to harvest that for the benefit and make it something, you know, turn something bad into something good as well.
Well, how big was your family then when you're in your upbringing?
So there were 4 of us. Yeah. My mother, my father, my older sister, she's 4 years older, and then myself.
So out of the 4 of you, I'm guessing each one had a way to cope. Your way wasn't really coping. I mean, I guess it really was, but it was more like you have a passion.
I avoided more than I coped.
Yeah. And you, for you, reading was an escape to another world and a new set of ideas and viewpoints. Were your siblings similar, or did they have other, maybe drawing or singing? Did they have another talent, another way of doing things?
My sister tended to get out of the house a lot. So she found outside, you know, she found activities outside of the house. Mm. She was much more the, you know, band kid and doing, you know, other sports and other things like that, that kept her out of the house. You know, my mother had a career and had a job and was very successful outside of the house as well. And then, you know, I spent a lot of time more avoiding than coping. I didn't cope and deal with a lot of the things about, you know, my father and all of those things until I was much, much older and much later in life. And I looked back on it and said, you know, and I went and got therapy and a professional help and other things to deal with it and get to a point where it's like, I can say out loud, yeah, my dad was an alcoholic. And, you know, there's things about my dad I love and I admire. And there's things about my dad that, yeah, not so great. You know, I'm not going to do that. I don't admire that about him.
Well, in a way,
I still love him and he was still my dad.
In a way, it's a good thing that I don't think avoiding is ever really that good. But in your situation, you were so young, you probably wouldn't have the tools to be able to deal with it properly until you were older anyways. So that escape of reading actually kind of played into helping a little bit. I mean, it probably, you know, stumbled the development in other areas, but it definitely helped increase your ability to benefit from reading for sure and learning from it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think we have different bents and different wirings. You know, I was never the go out and play sports and do all of that. That wasn't my bent. That wasn't what I enjoyed. I liked the intellectual pursuit of things. So that's what I gravitated to. You know, that was my way of dealing with the stress of the situation. Now, as an adult, I have to be aware of that because, you know, again, let's go back to the communication with your relationship kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm the one that if there's stress in the environment, I want to just go to my room and hide. You know, that's my natural, you know, I'm just going to go away from the situation. Let's avoid it. I don't want to deal with it. So as I've matured, I've had to learn that, okay, that's not healthy in all situations. So what can you do that, you know, you can deal with this in a much more healthy and balanced and harmonious way? And have the conversation, even though you'd rather avoid it, you know, that kind of thing. Again, you know, my wife grew up with her own history and her own pattern of behaviors and things that she naturally gravitates to. But if, you know, I think part of growing up, part of maturing is becoming aware of those patterns and aware of those things and learning ways to say, okay, I'm going to keep the things that are good and healthy, and I'm going to figure out ways to get rid of or mitigate the things that aren't healthy and aren't good.
Yeah, that's so true, because you grow to appreciate and love your parents as you get older, but also realize that they're not perfect. I mean, I think you realize that. You start realizing that in your teenage years, but then you start accepting it as you get older and, you know, then maybe showing love and appreciation for the good things that they did do, because you can now have the maturity to see, well, you know, this is what they were trying to achieve and this is the good that they were trying to do and here are the mistakes. But, you know, this is who they are, and I appreciate them for what they did. And it's not easy,
and you also
depending on the person.
That you also learned that as a kid, you did not come with an instruction book.
Yeah. Yeah. You realize your fault. Yeah. Your mistakes, your part in it too.
So your parents just did the best they could, you know, I mean, with incomplete. Yeah. Again, are there parents that do bad things? Absolutely. But most parents, I think, you know, want the best for their kids and are trying to do the best they can to parent them in a way that's good and healthy and everything. But they're people, you know, yeah. And so are you. Yeah. So they're going to screw it up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I joke to my son is my job. I tell my son all the time. I'm like, my job is to make sure you need therapy by the time you're 35. You know,
don't get it early because you're good so far. You didn't, none of that hit you until later.
You know, you haven't had it yet, but I'm trying. I'm aiming for it, you know, because there's some truth to that. You know, I think, and let's face it, as a teenager, you know, you believe that your parents know nothing and they're all idiots. I used to tell my high school students all the time, I'm like, you're going to be amazed at how much your parents learn in the next 6 years.
Yeah.
You know, because you graduate from high school. By the time you're about 26, you're like, man, my parents actually are kind of smart. They know some stuff. It's like, they must have learned a lot in the last 5 or 6 years. It's
yeah.
Like, no, they were always that smart. You just weren't listening, you know, but yeah, I mean, it's not a perfect situation on either side, but at the same time, yeah, you learn to grow and appreciate. And, you know, I have a wonderful relationship with my mother. My father's passed away a number of years ago, but you know, my mom and I still talk, you know, monthly and multiple times a month and text each other. And, you know, I have somebody I can reach out to for advice and talk to and bounce ideas off of. And, you know, I'm glad that I have that. And I hope that that's the relationship my son and I have, you know, years down the road. It is so far. And so I'm glad for that. But, you know, tying that back to the money, it's, you know, that's the same sort of pattern. Our money life shows up that I think most of us are trying to do the best we can with the information we have at the time that we have it. And yet we beat ourselves up. You know, we look back and we go, oh, look at all the stupid things I've done. And it's, you know, my encouragement for people is you probably didn't do it. You know, the information you had at the time you made the decision, it seemed like the best decision. Now you have new information and you're beating yourself up for not having that information. It's like, that's wrong. You can't do that because you've learned something. Instead, take that learning and figure out what can I do to make decisions now, today, that are different, that set me up for the future that I want. And when you start doing it that way, it lets you, you know, it lets you learn from the past, but not beat yourself up and judge yourself for all of those things. Because I think we all do it. We all get judgy, you know, about, oh, I was so stupid. Why did I do it that way? No, you weren't. You were you. You know, you were you then, and you made a decision. And yeah, maybe it was a bad one. Okay, well, what can we do different today?
Yeah. That's where real wisdom comes into play, because wisdom is accumulating the knowledge and not just accumulating it, but actually doing something useful with it and not being stuck in past, you know, errors, because that's the past, but you definitely want to learn from them. So in your situation, since you've learned so much and you're in a position where you're coaching and helping other people make, you know, 180s or 360s in some cases, because they did it themselves, you're trying to ideally a 180 for them to have a better outcome. But in your personal life now, with your son growing and getting older, there's going to be a time where he's going to appreciate, you know, having a father that has that education and that information and that history there. How do you begin to drip feed that information so that he's aware of the cost, the value, and, you know, just the finances that exist in the world that ties everything together? How do you introduce it at his age?
So we started when he was young. He's 19 now, and he actually has a job. He's working full time. He's kind of saving up some money to go to school eventually, but he's not, you know, not in a huge hurry for it, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. I'm fine with that. We started, you know, when he was 12, 13, we would give him, like, we had a budget for school clothes. Well, we would just give him the money. And we said, okay, this is your money for school clothes. Now, we're still your parents. We still get a vote, including veto power, you know, and we will guide you, but let's go school shopping. And all of a sudden it was like, you know, if I buy clothes at the thrift store, I can get 4 pairs of jeans for the same amount of money that 1 pair of jeans cost me at the big fancy brand store. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I can have some money left over. What happens if I have money left over? And it's like, you get to keep it. And you get to do whatever you want with it. Suddenly he became really frugal, you know, and we were buying the same school clothes, But it's like, oh, okay, I get some extra money. I get to buy a video game with that extra money.
He became an investor with it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and so we started doing it in little ways like that when he was younger. And then, you know, over time, you kind of give him a little more rope and give him a little more leeway. And, you know, we never gave him an allowance. We always had him on commission, which was, here's chores that you do because you're our son and you're part of the family and you're going to do a certain amount of work just because you live here. But here's chores that if you choose to do them, you get paid. And if you choose not to do them, you don't get paid.
Yeah.
Your choice. And guess what? He started doing those chores because it's like, huh, I work, I get paid. I don't work, I don't get paid. I want a video game. I'm going to go do the things that, you know, get me some money. Eventually, he started working out of the house some. And you know, like I said, now he's got a full-time job. And we sat down, he's got a full-time job. It's like, okay, let's talk about investing. Let's talk about options. Let's talk about what you want to do. And, you know, he's already started investing and for retirement. You know, he's 19 years old. He started a retirement account.
That's really smart, really wise at his age.
Well, yeah, it's compound interest. Yeah. You know? I mean, we sat down and I literally sat down and I'm like, if this is the only money you ever put in, you know, here's kind of the spread of kind of money you would have, you know, when you retire. Now, obviously, you're going to put in more money over time, but, you know, it's just that idea of, hey, you put in $3,000 or $4,000 and it's worth, you know, $200,000-$400,000. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it. Okay. Yeah. I can see the math, you know, let me do this. So it's really just encouraging those behaviors. And again, age appropriate. You know, when a 4-year-old cleans their room, it's a very different thing than when a 19-year-old cleans their room. You know, I mean,
ain't
you have
that
different expectations.
Yeah, that's so true.
You know, if 4-year-old basically means you clean the room and they kind of watch and halfway participate.
You keep the carpet away from that room.
Yeah, but you know, by 12, 13 years old, it's like, no, go clean your room. You know, you can do it. So you got to be age appropriate with it, but you just begin to give them those small steps. And give them more freedom and, you know, encourage the good decisions and reward them and talk about the bad decisions and what went wrong and what happened. And, you know, it could be a punishment, but usually the punishment's actually already happened because they made the poor decision. So you don't have to punish them. You know, it's really more about encouraging them. Okay, what did we learn from that? What are we going to do next and move forward? So, you know, he's got a pretty good head on his shoulders when it comes to money. You know, he's definitely made some money mistakes. We all have, but at the same time, I think he's set up, you know, pretty well, overall.
Have you ever sat down and been surprised by seeing positive, like you said, the fact that he was, once he heard that, wait, I can keep some of the money if I just, this is all I get for school clothes, right? But I get to keep it. It sparked something in him. And I'm sure that's a moment of pride to know that, you know, the teachings are growing, that seed is growing inside of him. But have you seen him or maybe heard him talk to his friends and no, John, that's not a good idea. You should really, you know, consider doing this with the money. Have you ever, have you stumbled upon a situation where you're like, wow, I'm really impressed and proud of the, you know, how he's growing into this mature person with finances? Has that happened or have you maybe heard of those situations?
Yeah, the biggest one for me was honestly when I just said he started investing for retirement, because he's the one that, you know, he started the job. He's actually been earning money. You know, he's got a budget. He's doing all of that. That was all kind of, I expected that. But he literally came to me and said, okay, because of where he works, they won't let him start retirement through work until he reaches a certain age and he's not quite there yet. So he's like, but I want to actually start saving some of this money for retirement now. Dad, how can I do that? And I said, well, here's how we would do it. You know, and he's like, okay, well, let me go research that. And he came back and he's like, okay, I've researched it. This is kind of what I want to think. I think I should do. What do you think?
Wow.
And we talked about it and, you know, it's like, yeah, that's a good decision, except maybe can, you know, let's look at this. And so we literally had a conversation about it and, you know, then I sat there with him while he opened the account and, you know, put the money in and everything, just because mechanically he's like, can you watch with me? I just want to make sure I fill out all the paperwork correctly. It's like, yeah, sure. So we did it together, but you know, he initiated that. I didn't come to him and say, hey, you need to start saving for retirement. He's like, I can't do it through work. I still want to do it. So how can I do it? And he started that conversation. So that was one that I would say, you know, especially recently, so it's probably kind of more immediacy bias of the fact that it just happened not too long ago that I'm thinking of it as a surprising event.
But what a proud moment as a dad, or as a, you know, just as a family, to know that the, you know, your kids, the work, the hard work you put in, even though, again, nothing is perfect, and neither, you know, what you're working with is malleable in many different ways. But the fact that they're growing in an upright position, you know, learning correctly and seeing the fruitage of your labor in a sense, because he's doing the same thing. He's learning from it. He's making smart decisions. And arguably set up better than you and many people in our generation were when we started off. It's such an encouraging thing to know that there's always, you know, if taught correctly, there's always an opportunity for someone to make right decisions and then pass those decisions on to someone else. So hopefully he's in a way and set up in a way in a couple of years from now, or, you know, many years from now, when he has his family of his own, he can then pass those lessons on. You know, this is from your grandfather. This is
absolutely.
It's such a beautiful thing to see, because it really does make life more enjoyable. It makes it so that you can enjoy living, not working, you know?
Well, and that's how you make generational change. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the truth is you make it by teaching values, not by passing down money. Mm-hmm. You know, because even if somebody inherits a lot of money, if they don't have the right value system, well, that money doesn't last anyway. You know, I love the people that are like, I inherited $1 million. I'll never spend all of that. I'm like, oh,
you know, you'd be surprised.
You know, that you can spend $1 million and nothing flat. You know, it does not take long at all. That's that kind of philosophy, rather than, wow, I've inherited $1 million from my uncle or from my grandmother or whatever. What can I do to pass that legacy on and change not just my life, but, you know, my children's life or my grandchildren's life? You know, that's where legacy and generational change happens. It's through that value system much more than the behavior. And don't get me wrong, you know, my son is a 19-year-old boy. Has he screwed things up? Absolutely. My wife and I were teasing him the other day about like all of the things he's done in school that got him in trouble. You know, we were like literally going back and forth with, remember when you did this? Remember when you did that? Remember when you did this? Like, yes, I remember. Stop. You know, leave me alone.
The old college hazing happening at home. It happens to everybody.
Absolutely. You know, it's, again, part of my job is to make sure he needs therapy by the time he's 35. Remember? So, you know, that's part of it. But at the same time, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I love the fact that I can walk in and I can look at my son and I can say, I love you, son. And he says, I love you too, dad. You know, I can still give him a hug and he'll hug me. You know, that's really the stuff that I think really matters, because, you know, at the end of the day, that's why he can come to me and say, hey, dad, you know, I want to start investing for the future. How can I do that? And trust my answer, and we can have that conversation. You know, because I think that there's a lot of 19-year-olds who are not going to ask their parent that, not because they don't want to invest, but because they don't feel like they have that trust in that relationship with their parents.
Yeah, so they see the mistakes of the parents. Know, yeah.
Yeah. You know, and they see, you know, not even just their mistakes. Oftentimes that's part of it, but they also see the fact that, you know, if I talk to my, they feel judgment, they feel out of place, they feel,
I see, yeah,
you know, all of those things that, you know, are again, I don't want to sound accusatory. They're understandable. We're all trying to do the best we can in a situation, but at the same time, they can create alienation, you know, for the teenager as well. Mm-hmm. That then drives them down the road to make another set of, you know, they get advice from their friends. They get advice from TV. They get advice from a radio show or whatever, and it may not be the best advice for them.
Yeah, I think that's true. A lot of there's groupthink in everything, even as adults, but for kids especially, because the decisions they make in most cases will haunt them years to come in the future. As an adult, the same thing happens, but as a kid, sometimes it can ruin the opportunity that you would have to work at a certain place or get into a certain college if you made, you know, again, a group decision that wasn't fully thought out and you didn't ask for your parents, you know, not even blessing, but just like their advice, their point of view on it. I think when you have a good relationship with your kids, it really changes the way that they develop and what happens in their kids' life subsequently too. I think that's incredibly beneficial. In fact, you know, I wanted to give you the kudos, because I know we're running out of time here. I out of many people that I've spoken to, the fact that you live by the code that you preach in in being able to inspire other people, motivate them. Some people can doubt the results, but the fact that you're showing fruitage from your kid, your son making the right decisions, your clients coming back happy, and you being able to stay debt free, it really highlights the benefit that most people, you know, don't think of, that they don't appreciate the fact that you can make a complete change in your life no matter what situation you're in currently. And I really appreciate that you are living by what you preach.
Absolutely. And thank you. I appreciate you sharing that and you calling that out. And I try. And, you know, again, I will also be the first one to tell you I screw it up and I don't do it perfectly and I still make, you know, bad decisions. But I think I make more good decisions than bad ones. And that's part of the underlying philosophy. And this is another phrase that I use so much, my clients all like repeat it to me now when I start to say it, which is, you know, I'm really aiming for progress, not perfect. I think a lot of times we hold ourselves up. We want, and I'm a perfectionist. I'm a closet perfectionist. I want everything to get perfect. You know, I hate it when things go wrong and I beat myself up for it. But over time, I've begun to take that philosophy of, you know what? Perfect's not even the goal. It's really about progress. Can I make a little improvement today? Can I do better today than I did yesterday? If I can, that's all. That's all I need to do. And if I do that a lot over time, it snowballs and I end up in a better place. And if I don't do that a lot over time, it snowballs and I end up in a less better place, you know? So I get to choose. I get to have the power of choice of what are those small decisions that I'm making today and how can I consistently make them over time so that they end up moving us in the direction that we want to go as a family versus how can I not make those decisions or make the wrong ones and end up in the place I don't want to go.
Yeah.
And that's really all it's about.
You know, I encourage anybody who's listening right now who has a, or in the future, anybody who has a small business, anybody who's trying to keep their finances on track, obviously your experience in your personal life and through the customers and through the different scenarios that we talked about really highlights your wisdom and experience in this area. I really would like for them to reach out. There's going to be some links in the chat or in the description box below for the Inspired Stewardship podcast, their website. And Scott, like, I don't know if you have any other social medias besides the one you sent me. I'm going to make sure those are on there. But do you have any words for those that are listening at home, anything that you'd like to let them know before we
absolutely
close?
I mean, the last thing I'll share is the website will be in the links, like you said, at inspiredstewardship.com. There's actually a meeting calendar link on there. And anyone that wants to have any conversations about where they're at and how maybe coaching could help them, feel free, jump on my calendar for 30 minutes. Even if you just want to chat, I do this on every podcast. There's no obligation, no free, you know, I'm not a high pressure guy. I'm not going to be like, it's not one of those, hey, at the end of this call, you got to make a decision today. You know, that I hate that mindset and that mentality. It's really just find out where you're at and whether or not coaching is something that would be right for you. So I'd look forward to talking to any of the listeners about where they're at and where they'd like to go and how maybe we could work together to get them there.
Awesome. Thank you, Scott, for your time. Thank you for being able to sit here with us and talk to us about this. I think this is a topic that's going to become more important. And I hope as you're listening, you understand, again, not to frighten anybody, but you know, the economy is in a moment, right? It's in a recession. So we want to make sure that everyone understands about the inflation, how that could affect you and how you can maybe take precautions and safeguards to be better off when everything is, you know, when that time is passed. So I really encourage everyone to look up information about it and please reach out to Scott. I think he's, out of all the people we've talked to, again, like you're very knowledgeable and I love the fact that you're sincere and have a really great approach to the conversation and really, you know, to the way you explain things. You come from a place where you have actually done it. And now you're here. You're not someone who just went to school and got a degree, understands the concepts, but never lived through it. So I appreciate that very much.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you all for listening. See you later.